The topic today is Priestley, Radcliffe, and the Gothic Grammar of Atmosphere. Please join me in warmly welcoming back to UCLA, Professor Jane Lewis.
Thank you so much. I'm still stuck back at intellectual work. I hope this counts. But anyway, I wanted to thank Rob and Claire and Liz for asking me to come in today to offer my own little prehistory of the environment in the form of a discussion of atmosphere. And it is really nice to be back here. I have been away for a while, but I do still walk with Bruin pride. So that's important to establish. And this is a little bit long as a talk, and I apologize for that, but I have some pictures to break up the monotony. That's primarily their purpose. My little boy helped design the PowerPoint, so if it gets a little flashy, that's not my doing. But anyway, I'll try to deal with this as best I can, and it will be a little bit of a distraction. Just before I start to say, as Rob said, this is part of a larger project, which looks at, actually pairs several different makers of British fiction, among whom I count Pope and Milton, as well as Defoe, Fielding, Lennox, and Radcliffe, with several natural philosophers, physicians, and meteorologists, avant la lettre, in order to show how intimately the air that appears in British fiction was involved with writing about the uniquely shapely and vaporous and changeable novel air of the British Isles. And I'm trying to kind of give a genealogy of that relationship. And this is really the last sort of chapter in that genealogy. And it considers the relationship between the Gothic novelist and Radcliffe. That's what I mean about the flashy graphics. The Gothic novelist and Radcliffe. And the pneumatic chemist, Joseph Priestley. So these are the two persons of interest in my talk today. Both of them are figures who are known to you, at least by reputation, I'm sure. Radcliffe, of course, the most popular, prolific, and influential Gothic novelist of the 1790s, who forged several enduring Gothic conventions, including one that leaked into other novelistic subgenres, which is depictions of the air. And air is, in fact, one of the most common words in all of her novels, but it's most common in her longest novel, The Mysteries of Udolpho, 1794, which is the novel that I'll be focusing on today, really in the first part of the talk. So the first part of the talk is going to be very much about her and that novel. And then the other figure is Joseph Priestley, who was the leading pneumatic chemist of the later 18th century, and someone who was very much at the forefront of the so-called chemical revolution, which began in the middle of the 18th century to analyze the entire natural world into gases. Everything could be composed into what Priestley called factitious airs, carbon dioxide, oxygen, carbon monoxide. Priestley is the one who really sort of set up that, that kind of approach to the natural world. And this contribution of his is embodied in his 1774 book, Experiments and Observations on Different Kinds of Air, which I put beside The Mysteries of Udolpho to give you a sense of the pairing here. And it's about the same length as Mysteries of Udolpho, same number of volumes, copious, intensely literary in its perceptions in lots of ways, and that's something I'm obviously really, really interested in. So I want to try to put these books really side by side and talk about their relationship to each other, and particularly thinking about them in terms of their common form, the media form in which they appear, which is writing, which I understand to be a kind of technology for engaging atmosphere in the period. So I think about the similarity, as I say, between these two works. If you know anything about Radcliffe or Priestley, as I'm assuming a lot of you do, you're probably more aware of their differences than their similarities. And just to give you an idea of how different they really are, Radcliffe was a recluse who left England in her life only once for Holland and the western frontiers of Germany, that despite the fact that she set all of her Gothic novels in remote locations like Italy and France. She wrote fiction, poetry, and one very brief theoretical essay on the supernatural in poetry, but by and large is a writer of imaginative literature. And someone who was very, in some ways, quite obscure, despite the incredible popularity of her work. people, if they knew anything about her in her lifetime, knew very little about her in her lifetime, and after her death, wild rumors floated that she'd been driven mad by her own writing. People confused her with the novelist Marianne Radcliffe, and she sort of dissolved, actually, into sort of false attribution thereafter. She's still somewhat shadowy kind of figure, and that's always appropriate for a Gothic novelist. Priestley, relentlessly sociable, and a friend of many major figures of the later part of the Enlightenment, Benjamin Franklin, Josiah Wedgwood, Erasmus Darwin, and so on. And someone who, moreover, as opposed to Radcliffe, who had a very highly mediated relationship to what she was writing about, considering she was writing about Italy and France and never venturing out of England, Priestley-based experiments and observations, very much on experiments and observations, and did it more or less in his spare time, as opposed to Radcliffe being very devoted to a particular kind of imaginative literature. Priestley was, among other things, a Unitarian minister and also an English professor who, in the decade leading up to experiments and observations, published numerous works on rhetoric, on grammar, perspective drawing, and history, and he moved on to the Christian Gospels. The other thing is Radcliffe's political reputation is something of a conservative. Priestley was a friend to the French and American revolutions. His laboratory and his library went up in flames at the Birmingham riots in the 1790s because of his support for those democratic movements. And he eventually, in fact, as opposed to Radcliffe, very Britain-bound, immigrated to western Pennsylvania, which is where he, and this is a direct quote from Priestley, ceased to breathe when I had just begun to know what it is I breathe. So, but he did continue his New Haven researches with American air, for whatever it's worth. So two very different figures, but in putting their work side by side and thinking about them together, I hope to turn our attention really to what they have in common, which is a language of the air, and implicitly, therefore, a language about the environment, the world around us, the physical world around us. And given that they do have this commonality, one of the questions we have to ask is why their respective idioms within that common language have come to be valued so differently and to circulate in such different worlds. So that's the kind of question that I'm moving toward. And moving toward that question or mystery, I will start with a quote from Experiments and Observations. I had it on the screen originally. I'm not going to go back, so then I have to thread my way all the way back through these to get to the next picture. But the citation, the epigraph of the talk is as follows. I read it, I'll just start reading the talk. The circumstances, this is Priestley in Experiments and Observations, the circumstances in which any kind of air is decomposed tend to discover its composition. So I want to start with a grammar point. Just what is it we mean when we say that a literary work, but most especially a work of fiction, has an atmosphere? What might this term, and the presumably common experience that it conjures, have to do with the atmosphere? Such questions are, so to speak, in the air right now, not least because we're kind of worried about how long either literary fiction or the air about us might last in its present form, about the nature, degree, and significance of our contribution to the shelters that both provide. It doesn't help that it's so hard to say exactly what either a literary atmosphere or the atmosphere about us actually is. With respect to books, we can mutter all we want about mood and voice, the German Stimmung, or we can parse novelistic weather reports, fog everywhere, it was a dark and stormy night, to our heart's ever elusive content. Speaking of elusive, who was it? William Empson. William Empson tried to decide what literary atmosphere might be. Here it is, an undifferentiated mode of being that is conveyed to some in some unknown and fundamental way as a byproduct of meaning. In the end, Empson threw up his hands. What was atmosphere? I quote, analysis cannot hope to do anything but ignore it, he concluded. And criticism can only state that it is there. As for this so-called sphere of vapors that literally surrounds us and upon which we so manifestly and entirely depend, Karl Marx was surely equally right to find Capital, I quote, that after the discovery of the compound gases of the air, the atmosphere remained unaltered.